From Brandeis University, welcome to Recall This Book, a podcast that looks backward to see into the future. Our idea is to put together scholars and writers from different disciplines to make sense of contemporary issues, problems, and events by looking at books that shape the world we inherited. Our topic today is the comic novel, its past, its future, and most importantly, its present. What do we read comic novels for? Do they comfort us? Do they unsettle us? Do they make us better? Do they make us worse? Are they the predecessor of sitcoms or a classier alternative to TV? I'm sure that the answer to all those questions is probably no, but it will be revealed in the next half hour. And today I am a solo host, so hello, John Plotz, and I'm lucky to be joined by Steve McCauley. You probably know him as the author of a raft of comic novels. They include recent favorites like My Ex-Life, which he had a wonderful interview about with Terry Gross on Fresh Air, Alternatives to Sex, and even and Insignificant Others. Perhaps, like me, you have been his fan ever since Object of My Affection, or perhaps you came on board more recently when he started publishing his Tales from the Yoga Studio series under the delightful pen name of Rain Mitchell. So I love every phase of Stephen McCauley's career, and I'm really honored to be speaking with him today. So, Steve, welcome.
Hello. Thanks, John.
Yeah?
I'm glad you're delighted with every phase of my career.
I am.
I'm not delighted with any phase of my career, so maybe well,
think,
but that
I
balances
I think it's the terminal one I'm going to like best of all, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
I really want the yoga series to have to be a very long and fruitful phase.
Oh, okay. So. Yeah, I think that phase has passed already, but
really?
We can get to that later.
Okay. My wife just signed us up for a gentle yoga class, so I think I definitely need something to guide me into that world.
Yeah.
You know that I can barely touch my knees, right?
So, really?
Yeah.
You are doing it now.
Well, I am touching my knees now, but that's because I'm crammed into a chair.
That's true. That helps.
So Steve and I put our heads together and decided we would start in a curious kind of way today, which is to start by trading favorite lines from Barbara Pym, whom we have both decided is, if not the queen of the comic novel, then at least one of its reigning monarchs. Okay, so Steve, can I start by asking you, why have we decided that, and who is Barbara Pym exactly?
So Barbara Pym is a British novelist who had two interesting phases to her career. She was born in 1913, I believe, and she published six novels that were fairly successful. They were well received. They had a readership. Yeah. And then she wrote
starting in 1950, I think.
Yeah. And she very much feels like a mid-century novelist to me, you know, her sensibility and pushing against more contemporary issues and themes in the later half of the century. Yeah. But in any case, she wrote her seventh novel, which is called An Unsuitable Attachment, and her publisher decided that it was not current enough, that she didn't have an audience, and he turned it down. It was turned down by many publishers, and this kind of launched her into a period of kind of darkness, both personal and professional.
Yeah. And so that was like in 1963, I think, that she wrote it. So I guess sort of the Beatles are big, cars are suddenly painted bright colors in England, and everybody is swinging, and they thought she wasn't swinging.
And she indeed was not swinging. Yeah. She was writing about, you know, villages and curates and anthropologists and things that were not really of the moment, I suppose.
You could argue about anthropologists. Those were kind of...
Well, that's true. But not her anthropologist.
Yeah, that's true.
But in any case, and then, do you remember the year that this came out? There was a Times Literary Supplement in, I think, 1977 or 78, and they named... They asked a bunch of prominent writers and social critics.
Including Philip Larkin, I think, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And I think that was, Quartet in Autumn, which is the first one after that, came out in 77. So maybe it was just before that.
It was just before that. So maybe it was around 76. And they asked all these people to name the most underrated British novelist. And Philip Larkin and one other person both named Barbara Pym, which kind of inspired a lot of interest in her work. Yeah. And then she finally published this novel called Quartet in Autumn. Yeah. And her career was revitalized. And that was the period in which I began reading her and in which a lot of Americans that I knew discovered her and just became tremendously fond of her whole body of work.
Yeah. So you mentioned really quickly the mid-century. So in other words, the people you think about with her first phase are someone like Muriel Spark. Is that right? Prime of Miss Jean Brodie. Would that be a good comparison for what who she was writing with?
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, I think that her name is sometimes mentioned with Muriel Sparks. I'm not sure it's quite. Muriel Sparks seems much more adventuresome stylistically and much more edgy in terms of what she does with characters, I think, than Pym.
Okay, so that's interesting. I kind of want to get back to that question of what the edge is, because maybe we disagree about this, but part of what I love about comic novels is it seems to me that there really is an edge there, but it's just sometimes a little bit buried. And it's not necessarily there in the characters per se. In other words, the people's lives themselves may not be that grandiose, but the edge might be at a deeper level. But,
And I think it's also in the attitude toward their lives.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, there's this wonderful, Barbara Pym's best known novel is called Excellent Women.
Mm-hmm.
And this was her, I believe it was her second published novel.
Yeah, 1952. Yeah.
And, you know, this is the narrator talking about herself. I suppose an unmarried woman just over 30 who lives alone and has no apparent ties must expect to find herself involved or interested in other people's business. And if she is also a clergyman's daughter, then one might really say that there is no hope for her. And, you know, it's such a kind of sharp-eyed look at the character looking at herself.
Yeah.
And later she says, you know... she compares herself to Jane Eyre in what I think is a very amusing way, but I'm not sure I can find it right now. But anyway.
Yeah. Actually, one of my favorite lines, since it seems like we've now started quoting favorite lines, one of the favorite lines that I was going to pick out from An Unsuitable Attachment, which, as you said, Steve, is the one that kind of got her kicked to the curb originally, but then was reissued. Right. I think only after her
after her death.
Yeah. So also talking about a parish priest. Although invariably kind and courteous, he had the air of seeming not to be particularly interested in human beings, a somewhat doubtful quality in a parish priest, though it had its advantages. I just love the crisscrossing of that sentence, you know? It brings you sort of to the left bank and then back to the right bank and then back to the left bank again. Somewhat doubtful, though it had its advantages.
Right.
So it does... I think this really goes along with the point you're making about the attitude taken towards characters, even though they may be in a very banal and apparently benign setting.
Yeah.
But, you know, even those settings have their swift water and their dark places.
Yeah. And this quality of being able to see both sides or all sides of a person's character, I think, is very much Barbara Pym.
But what I was going to say, so you know, taking Jane Eyre or Middlemarch as our model, you know, these are novels that are... they're meant to be realist. I mean, they define the word realism. And yet, they're always about moral improvement. Either the moral improvement of the characters who are supposed to have come to a better place in life, or implicitly because the reader is meant to be, you know, improved out of their bad habits, out of their laziness, out of their desire to sit around reading novels. You know, by the end of the novel, there's going to have been a nudge. It's kind of the difference between the is and the ought.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it opens up that space. And I do think that comic novels are so delightful because they drop that moral pretense or something like that. Like, they're not improving you.
Yeah.
Which is kind of what I was trying to get at, whether they're better than sitcoms, you know? I mean, I just think...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, but sitcoms can be so... moral, you know, they always have a moral.
You're right.
It's like it has to be redemption at the end.
So they're better by not being moral, in other words, is what you're saying.
The comic novel.
Yeah.
Comic novel. I mean, and obviously we're talking in, you know, gross generalizations here, but I mean, I think that the one of the reasons that comic novels can be so subversive is because they're not trying to do that.
Yeah.
And if you think about something like Gentlemen Prefer Blondes by Neal Luce, which was published in the 1920s. Yeah. And you have a character.
I tried to write a novel about her once, actually. I love her.
About Anita Luce?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It was about her early days because, you know, she was in California just sending screenplays in to Griffith trying to get them produced.
And I think she actually sold one when she was about 14.
Something. You know, she's a little bit older because she lied about her age. She actually didn't start selling them until she's like 21 or 22. She's from a theatrical family.
Yeah.
It's a really interesting story. In my novel, she meets Mark Twain on the Lower East Side in 1905, which I don't think actually did happen. But
it might.
But the point is that I think of her as taking the mantle of Mark Twain for sure.
Yeah. Yeah.
So sorry. So go ahead. So
But Lorelei Lee, the character, the famous character of In Gentlemen for Blondes, is a gold digger. She is completely amoral. She is only out to improve herself in terms of wealth, and will just, destroy as many marriages and wreck as many homes as she possibly can. And, unlike, say, in Edith Wharton, where, there's no character quite like that in Edith Wharton, but nonetheless.
No, but if Lily Bart is on the rise.
Yes, and then she must be punished, right?
Chloral will be administered,
Yeah.
But
she triumphs. Lorelei Lee triumphs.
So then Becky Sharp
and
in Vanity
who,
Fair
yes.
is your, sorry.
Yeah, go ahead.
No, Lorelei.
Well, I was just going to say, after all, she is the person who coined the phrase, Anita Luce's, diamonds are a girl's best friend, right? Which is pretty subversive when you
And did she coin Gentlemen Prefer Blondes also, or is that?
Well, that's the title of the book.
Yeah, but it was, Yeah.
I don't know.
It's hers. Okay. Yeah. We'll give it to her.
Well, let's give it to her.
Yeah. No, it's a really good point also about sitcoms needing to trot out the moral, the big moral hammers at the end.
Right.
Okay. Well, so that really does make me think about Vanity Fair as the one 19th century realist novel that actually sort of refuses the moral improvement path. And there's a super interesting story to be told about how, like, later novelists who loved Thackeray, I think, insisted on misreading him. So George Eliot loves him, Trollope loves him, Charlotte Bronte loves him, but I don't think they get that anti-moral side to him.
Yeah.
So wait,
it'd be hilarious to think of Charlotte Bronte as a comic novelist.
But she dedicated, Jane Eyre is dedicated to Thackeray because she said that Vanity Fair did what she wanted Jane Eyre to do. So it's really funny. Huh. I agree. Maybe that gets to another thing, Steve, that you were interested in talking about, which is whether the comic novel gets the respect it deserves. And maybe we could start by getting at a question that you, I know, think about, which is like distinguishing the respect it gets in America versus the respect it gets in England. I mean, is that worth talking about? Who are the American comic novelists? Like you mentioned Anita Luce. Would you put, does Mark Twain fit in the comic novel? Because I was thinking, because he himself says he does humorous writing, not comical.
He did. I don't know. What do you think?
I really don't know, because I take his distinction seems really interesting to me. He says that comedy is where you basically have a gag, and that humorous writing is more like getting into a particular voice and just extending that voice.
Right.
So, even Huck Finn is humorous because you're sort of entering into the mind of Huck.
Yeah.
And I kind of think that might be right.
Uh-huh.
Though he's incredibly funny on a line-by-line basis, too. But I think he's not trying to do the same thing that comic novels are.
Mm. But aren't there scenes in Huck Finn that seem sort of broadly comedic?
Absolutely. I mean, yes, there are.
So maybe he was just trying to distance himself from the scourge of being labeled a comic novelist.
I think that makes sense, because there were these, comic writers before him who he was trying to push away.
Yeah.
So what about somebody like James Thurber then?
Well, to me, he's more of a humorist.
Uh-huh.
I'm not sure really what the distinction is, if I could really make it very precise, but it seems to me that what he was doing was a little different.
Yeah. So can I give you a James Thurber line that I was thinking about whether it applies to the comic novel or not? So Thurber said, "The laughter of man is more terrible than his tears and takes more forms, hollow, heartless, mirthless, maniacal." Is that too dark for you?
No, I love it. I think it's great.
He also said, here's another one that seemed to me to kind of get at what I love about comic novels. "Man has gone long enough, or perhaps too long, without being man enough to face the simple truth that the trouble with man is man." Which I take to mean something like that you can outrun everything except yourself. Like that a lot of novels that we call realist, including those novels that I love in the sort of George Eliot tradition, have this vision that if you can just get far enough, then you don't you will not carry your own troubles with you.
Right,
like
right.
all those things you didn't like about yourself can somehow be, yeah. you know, just shed.
Right, right, right.
Whereas the point of the comic novel is kind of like, if you look behind you, your butt is still there.
Yeah.
You
know, like, so it's
no
not...
matter how fast you're going, your butt will still be the same distance from your mouth as it was before.
Yeah. So there's that question of the kind of lack of redemption or...
Yeah.
I don't know.
Well, yeah, something about just, I don't know, just that we're earthy, you know, like it or not.
Yeah.
I mean, I do think it's interesting, one of Barbara Pym's novels is called Less Than Angels, right? Uh-huh. And I kind of feel like that's right. Like, more than dirt.
Right.
Like, we're not just dirt, because then there wouldn't be anything to say.
Yeah.
But we're not angels either.
Yeah.
So.
And the shifts in her characters are very, very subtle. I mean, we don't see big changes in her characters, you know, from the beginning to the end. I mean, they open up just a little bit and let in maybe a little bit more light or a little bit more warmth, perhaps.
Yeah.
But they're not completely transformed by their experiences.
Yeah.
I also think the other thing that's maybe this is a little off topic, but that's just so fascinating to me about having read a couple of her novels recently, reread, is the lack of what we typically think of as plot. That they are just they are almost like these anthropological studies of a period of time within a village and observations of the people's behavior.
So I have another line that sort of goes to that, and then I have a question to ask you, which is basically like how important the sentence is in the comic novel, or whether anything else is as important as the sentence. Okay, so this is a line which is, you know, one of the young men who may or may not be involved with. It's about he's just seeing a woman he might be interested in. The heavy scent she wore tantalized him because it was one he knew, though he could not remember its name. So, okay, so far that could be a sentence from like any realist novel, any mystery, any romance, anything. Though he could not remember its name, whether it was an evocative French phrase or a downright English word like carpet or swamp.
Yeah.
And I just... So we're like I was talking about that other sentence that kind of crisscrosses. This one to me, it's more just like it lands with a thump, you know, like you think you're gliding through a gentle forest glade and then you smack into a concrete wall.
Yeah.
Carpet or swamp.
Yeah. And so, I mean, in terms of the sentence, it's like those words are just so perfectly chosen.
Right.
And they not only because of what they, you know, refer to in concrete terms, but also just the sound of the words.
Yeah.
And,
good diphthongs. Know. Like swamp has two good diphthongs in it. Yeah. So I guess, so my question is for that is whether what's satisfying in Barbara Pym is just really funny sentences or whether it's what the funny sentences are doing. I mean,
you know, I think it's both, right? Because I think that she both has this, phrasing that is very well chosen and I'm sure does not trip off the top of the tongue as they appear to be on the page. But also that, you know, what you just read reveals something about the character, reveals something about their attitude towards themselves as a British person, you know, et cetera. So I think it's both. I think it has to be both, or else to have the depth of comic resonance and also just kind of, you know, human, I don't know, observation that her novels have.
So this is a totally banal question, but do you think there's a limit to how long a comic novel can be? I can't help noticing how short they are.
There's a limit to how long hers can be.
Yeah.
I mean, Vanity Fair is...
Yeah.
Pretty long.
It's true.
Novel.
I know. Yeah.
Tristan
I guess
Shandy.
I'm not. Tristan Shandy. Oh, interesting. Okay. That's a gag book, though.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, okay. So let me ask it another way. Like, James Thurber, I mean, there's many reasons that Thurber doesn't fit, but partly he was a sketch writer, basically.
Yeah.
So I'm just thinking there's a way in which it's not easy to write 20 pages worth of funny material. I mean, I can't do it, but I mean, a lot of people have done it. Like on the, if you think about The New Yorker, is full of brilliant writers who can sustain something for 15 pages.
Right.
But Barbara Pym and you, and we're about to get to you, like are people who can write novels that are, you know, 200 pages long. And that's So I guess I'm flipping the question of the length, but I mean, it does seem like it's rare to be able to pull it off.
Well,
maybe a novel length.
Well, sure. I mean, anything is difficult to pull off for an extended period of time.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that the novel that I have read most recently that just exhausted me with its comic brilliance is The Cello by Paul Beatty.
And I wish Elizabeth Ferry were here because she completely agrees with you.
And that, I mean, almost to the point where, okay, I just had to put the book down and say, I give up, you know, because it's like every sentence is so brilliant and so witty and so extraordinarily well-constructed to both make a point, which is invariably extremely subversive, and also hilariously funny, although you find yourself, like, wary of laughing at it sometimes. But, you know...
Yeah,
it's rare to be able to sustain that for that.
Yeah. So do you have a thought about that? I mean, again, this is another version of the question about, like, you know, carpet or swamp. Like, I just have this image of Barbara Pym doing stand up in some club in the north of England, in Bradford. I got a lot of great material here, but somehow it isn't just that. She strings together those. I take your point. You're saying that the sentences work because they're funny in their own terms, but they also go to revealing something about, the way this character sees the world as distinct from how all the people around them see it.
I think in the case of Pym, maybe even more so than in the case of The Sellout, is that... it's all about the context of the characters and the world that she has created for them. And that's what makes it funny, is the context of their relationships with each other, what they overlook, what they refuse to discuss, and so on. To me, that's crucial. So I don't think of her as being a stand-up person at all. I mean, would you say, what about Philip Roth, for instance? You know, like, Portnoy's Complaint is basically a 300-page stand-up routine.
Right.
It's a 300-page Lenny Bruce routine. Only actually funnier, I think.
Yeah. So does he count? So is that a comic novel then?
Oh, man, I think so.
Oh, that's so interesting. Yeah.
Don't you?
It's so terrible to admit, but I've never been able to finish that book. I
mean,
I like his later ones.
Yeah.
Like, I like Exit Ghost, for example. Yeah. I mean, I like the ones. So it's not that I don't like him when he's being sharp and sort of one-liner-ish, but I feel like Philip Roth is better. I don't know. I love American Pastoral. Mm-hmm. Like, I love it. I think he's better when he turns that that wit into something. I feel like sometimes Philip Roth is stacking up razor blades. Like, sometimes he's just cutting. Mm-hmm. And Portnoy's Complaint, to me, it's just like, it feels like flailing. I believe you that it isn't. But when I read American Pastoral, I feel like it's actually like adding up to something.
Yeah. Well, I mean, Portnoy's Complaint, I think one of the great things about Portnoy's Complaint is that it feels, and I believe this is how it was written, supposedly, was just someone sitting down and ranting, for however long it took him to get out the first draft of that novel.
Yeah.
And that, too, is an incredibly exhausting novel. And, the last line of the novel, the last word is this, kind of cry in front of the therapist, right? And you, as a reader, you share that feeling like,
Yeah. Okay, but so this is great, because I would have said, if we think about Barbara Pym, she's not exhausting. Like, there's lots of things.
No.
It's comforting, right?
It's more subtle. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes, and
I think
one of the...
but it's also not raw. I mean, it doesn't feel...
Well, there's a kindness to it at the same time that... I think she is misunderstood, and sometimes I will say to people, oh, have you read Barbara Pym? And they say, is she that, like, cozy writer with the kind
yeah,
of...
Yeah, I didn't mean cozy.
The book covers that look like wallpaper
so
on.
Yeah.
And which is what they do look like.
Yeah.
But she's not at all, because she is so incisive, and because she's really quite critical, and there's a real darkness there. And if it weren't for the funny twist and, you know, of the carpet and stuff,
yeah,
a lot of these people's lives might be considered tragic.
Right.
What was your question?
Well, I mean, no, the question is like whether the rawness of that kind of cry at the end of Portnoy's complaint and the subtleness of Barbara Pym are like on the same spectrum or not. And I hear what you're saying. You're saying that it's a subtler kind of vinegar that she's dispensing, but I almost feel like it's vinegar she's made into lemonade. Like, to me, the comic novel, it's hit the sweet and sour balance, right?
Right.
And it's not cozy, but I think you can say that something is comforting without it being cozy. Like,
absolutely,
there's lots of novelists I find incredibly comforting to read.
Yes. And in fact, I know that you're not fond of this author, but I'm equally obsessed with Anita Bruckner, who wrote 27 novels, I believe, and they're all basically about loneliness,
yeah,
you know, about some form of loneliness, kind of lives that have not advanced in the way that the character hoped that they would advance, and so on and so forth. It is the opposite, and she has a very bleak vision. She's witty. She's certainly not comic, and she sometimes is funny.
Right.
But anyway, a friend who I've, you know, turned on to her, we all say the same thing. This is like the least comforting worldview you can imagine, and yet there's something tremendously comforting about opening up one of her books and entering that world again. And that is somehow familiar, that you're in control of this beautiful, you feel as if this writer has this tremendously great grasp of language.
Yeah.
And I feel the same way with Pym.
So maybe witty is an indispensable part of being a comic novelist, but it's not by itself. It doesn't make you a comic novelist. In other words, there's lots of people who are witty who aren't writing comic novels, but it's hard to imagine.
Yeah, like Henry James, maybe, you know.
But it's hard to imagine.
I actually think Beast in the Jungle is hilarious.
Yeah. So what about Mary McCarthy then? Because she's, to me, feels the way you're describing Anita Bruckner. Like, do you feel
I think Mary McCarthy is more...
It's too sardonic?
Yeah, I think it's way more sardonic.
Yeah, it can't be a comic novel. It's that sardonic, yeah. It's funny,
But I think she's, I mean, I don't know, The Group, I mean...
Yeah.
That's pretty satirical, right?
Yeah, it's satirical. I'm struggling with this right now because I'm trying to write about both comical science fiction and satirical science fiction.
Uh-huh.
And my idea is that those two things are close to each other. And last night, Lisa just looked at me and she's like, why would you assume that satire and comedy are the same thing? You know, so it's a good distinction.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, it's true I don't like Anita Bruckner, Steve, but I do really like this guy, Steve McCauley.
Oh,
so let's talk about him. Okay, I'm just going to read the first line of Object of My Affection. In fact, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to read the first line and then I'm going to also... sorry, spoiler alert, but I'm going to read the last line of the novel too. And I'm actually going to try not to give away all the plot details of your novel because if people haven't read it, it's so great and they should go out and read it.
I'm never bothered by spoilers.
Oh, really?
I don't read because I want to, if I know what's going to happen at the end of a book, it doesn't spoil it for me.
Okay. All right, well...
And I don't remember what happens at the end of this one, so, you know.
Actually, one of the things that really made me mad at the movie is that they don't end up in the right ride in the movie. They end up riding a roller coaster, but I think it's so great that they end up riding the octopus at the end of the book. But okay, so first couple of lines. Nina and I have been living together in Brooklyn for over a year when she came home one afternoon, announced she was pregnant, tossed her briefcase to the floor, and flopped down on the green vinyl sofa. As if I don't have enough problems with my weight already, she said. Nina's lower lip was thrust out, but I couldn't tell from her expression if she was genuinely upset, so I used my standard tactic for dealing with anything unexpected. I changed the subject. I pointed out a water stain on the hem of her dress and passed her half the sandwich. We're out of ketchup, I apologized. There's this sort of Bergsonian quality to humor, that the humor of life is like seeing us all sort of attached to as repetitive machinery, like where we just keep doing the same damn stuff over and over.
Yeah, that when people begin acting like mechanized dolls, there's something inherently funny in that. I mean, that's this Bergsonian idea of comedy. And that is certainly, I think, in Pym, in that these characters stick so much to their limits and their views of the world. You know, the cat lady, which is runs throughout many of her books, that person.
Why? That is such a good gag. It's like a perennially good gag. It's like in Unsuitable Attachment.
Right.
You know, every time you think she's about to say something serious, it turns into a remark about horse
about
meat for the cat.
Yeah, exactly.
Right, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's and I wonder if she intentionally did that, like with all of her books, as a you know, cat person in there. Or if it's just anyway, but
so you're saying that begins funny and ends sad.
That well
the fact
you know
of that,
what it does in life.
Yeah,
it does in
yeah.
life. If you don't change, you know, then I think you're headed for a kind of sadness. Certainly. But I think, I mean, just in my own sense of what I want to do in my books is to have the characters face something and then change as a result of it and understand that there are consequences for either pushing away the discussion about the pregnancy, you know, and talking about the absence of ketchup in the house, that, you know, you do that for long enough and then you kind of have to pay for it eventually. And then things get a little bit sadder and darker.
Yeah.
And so, to me, that's very satisfying. You know, it's very satisfying to write.
That seems to go against Northrop Frye's definition of comedy. Because his definition of comedy is that comedy is basically the genre where, through a totally unforeseen set of circumstances, we arrive at a happy ending. Like, in other words, if Romeo and Juliet are in the tomb and he takes the poison, boy, that's tragedy. But if he figured out just in time not to take the poison, or the poison was sugar water, then it would be comedy. Like, that's the Northrop Frye definition, is it's all about the upbeat outcome. Mm-hmm. But you just gave a totally persuasive description of what you do, which is almost like the opposite, which is that it's really witty all throughout, and it's really funny all throughout, but it actually ends sadder than it began, because it ends with us being able to see the limits of these people.
Well, I mean, you know, by that strict definition, then, then they're not comic novels, really, because they always, I mean, my books always have a kind of a bittersweet ending where there's something, just because I don't believe life turns out that way, you know, usually, that there's a blend of happiness and sadness. And So that's kind of what I think.
A blend not reflected in the film version of Object of My Affection.
No, but, you know, they did film the ending that I wrote.
Really?
And they screened it
and
for focus groups, and everybody hated it.
Yeah.
So they put on this kind of upbeat, unambiguous ending.
Yeah.
Unlike the French
adaptations. Well, I call it, it's like the Brooklyn Heights Dog and Pony Show. They were like, and we're all together.
Yeah.
Like, it's not enough to have, you know, they had to make it racially mixed. They had to make it, sex positive, choice mixed.
Right.
And,
you know, and that's the Hollywood movie. And that creates a certain kind of satisfaction for the viewer, for sure.
Yeah.
But I'm saying that I've had these two French adaptations of my novels, too.
Yeah.
And they, you know, make the endings even more ambiguous.
Interesting.
You know, they don't want any kind of resolution at the end of them.
So I was thinking of a really weird analogy as I was finishing Object of My Affection. Again, I'm... Even though you don't care about spoilers, I do. So, but I'll just say, one of the things that's great about the novel to me is that you can't. It does. It resists the temptation to put people into the box, which is either happy homosexual pair, happy heterosexual pair, or busted, you know, failed love. It actually explores the ways in which people can be different things to one another. So you can have a friendship which isn't based on the set of phrases that you've been handed already. And so here's the crazy analogy I thought of, which is Jude the Obscure, which ends a lot darker than any of your books do. But, this Thomas Hardy novel, which is really about what it means to want to be friends with someone but not actually be married to them, you know, like to have a relationship that is neither one thing or the other.
Right.
Is that, I mean... Is that a thing for you, Steve? Is that something you're interested in? That
yeah,
way
I mean,
of
that's
like,
yeah. that's like what my most recent novel, My Ex-Life, yeah. is. It's about a relationship that is neither one thing yeah. nor the other. You know, it's like a previously married couple who reconnects 30 years later and, you know, he's gay. They know it's not going to be a sexual relationship. They're not, unlike in Object of My Affection, where at least half the couple, you know, would like it to be. That isn't the case. And their needs are different now. Their expectations are different for relationships. And so they're trying to construct something yeah. that's more interesting. Maybe the word is just more doable for their particular
yeah.
Qualities as individuals. And honestly, you know, I think that's how a lot of relationships end up anyway, you know?
Yeah.
It's like it's the... companionship and that sort of thing.
Yeah. So, final comic novel twist on that is that they're going back to that Northrop Frye idea. Northrop Frye's idea makes the basic genre of the comic novel seem kind of basic. It's about girl gets boy, girl doesn't get boy. It's courtship. It ends with the happy marriage, and when it ends with the "and they lived happily ever after." That's the Northrop Frye version of what the genre is doing. But what you've been describing, not just for your own writing, but I mean, just looking back to Barbara Pym or to Anita Luce or other people we've talked about that you love,
other Anitas,
yeah. It seems like actually you're actually arguing the opposite, which is that the comic novel works because it allows you to see people in their neither one thing nor the otherness, right? That, in other words, that there's the generic solution out there, but in real life, people don't find that solution. They find some other solution.
Yeah, and maybe that makes the some of these novels that we've been talking about less satisfying for certain kinds of readers. Like the students of mine who are complaining that the books aren't funny enough, maybe that's what they are looking for. They're looking for a Hollywood rom-com. And there are plenty of novels that would fit that bill. Just for me, they're maybe, you know, a little bit less interesting. And I also think, though, that as a writer, and frankly, as a reader, too, one of the nice things about not being a critic and not reading a whole lot of critical work of that sort is that you don't have to fit into these definitions. You don't have to try to. You know, you can just, invent whatever feels right for the characters and your particular voice.
Yeah. So could you imagine a novel called Carpet or Swamp? I agree.
Like by William S. Burroughs or someone, you know?
But I mean, I agree with what you're saying, Steve, but I also think it's something more than that. I think you're saying, at least I'm convinced from this conversation that what makes the comic novel so satisfying isn't just that it might or might not happen to fit into those formats. It's that it actually allows you to see life... just to see the way that life doesn't actually fit into those forms. Like, we're handed those forms. I mean, you know, everyone knows the kind of Anne Hathaway, you know, princess movie version of what you're supposed to be like when you're grown up. And then you grow up and you fall in love with somebody or you fall out of love with somebody and you realize, oh, well, wait a second, it doesn't look like that. It looks like it's kind of like the first cousin of that. And the comic novel seems to be sort of committed to saying, well... actually, yeah, if you look at people in their quirkiness and the fact that they have their own bodies and their own habits and their own, you know, things that they're kind of ashamed of, but they keep doing them anyway.
Right.
Like, that's what we all are. And, you know.
Yeah. And so. That's kind of the beauty of it, I guess.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think, too, like, I mean, I recently read a comic novel that ends very happily and, for me, unconvincingly. And it was one of these novels that I threw across the room because I felt like, you know, I've invested all this time in these characters and in this world and it's not, the ending wasn't earned. The happiness of the ending wasn't earned. I would much rather have seen an unhappy ending, although it was outside of the convention that this novel was clearly working in.
Hey, and speaking of conventions, Steve, didn't you want to... put in a plug for a Barbara Pym convention?
Yeah, Barbara Pym has maintained a long-standing kind of cult following many years after her death.
Well-deserved.
Yes, and the Barbara Pym Society, which you can find online, has, I think, three conventions a year, one of them in Boston, on the weekend of March 22nd, 2019, at the Harvard Law School. And people present papers and about her work.
So, I love that.
Yeah.
That sounds great.
Would you go?
I don't know. I really, really have to read Sweet Dove Died. Yeah. And I also now have to reread Less Than Angels because what you were saying about the... I was just remembering how satisfyingly unsatisfying the ending of that novel is. Mm. But yeah, if people are talking about those ones, sure. Okay. Sure, I would go. Yeah. I would go to a Muriel Sparks Society meeting too, though.
So. Yeah.
And I'm also a fan of the Doris Lessing novels that you make fun of in Object of My Affection.
So. Oh, right. Without having read.
Don't admit that on tape.
I know. No,
okay, so Steve, this has been an awesome conversation. And as you know, we conclude with recallable books, which is basically a recommendation for further reading on the topic. I got to say, this whole discussion has been like a set of recommendations for me. I have like 20 more books to read now. But... as with all the books that we discussed today, we're going to, you know, recommend a couple of books, and then there will be links to those on our website, along with other material for people who want to explore this topic further, or people who want to write in and tell us what they thought about, you know, their definition of the comic novel. So, so Steve, can I ask you what book you're going to plug for recallable books?
Yeah, I'm going to plug a very dangerous book.
Oh, good.
That was originally published around, I think, 1974. It's called After Claude, and it was written by Iris Owens.
Oh, my God. I've never heard of it.
And it was recently, or maybe within the last 6 years, let's say, reprinted by New York Review Books.
Yeah.
And it is a very extreme novel in many ways.
Yeah.
It's kind of, my definition of it is it's like a Jean Rhys novel
with...
this killer sense of humor, which Jean Rhys novels
do not have. Yeah.
And this novel turns extremely dark and forbidding sort of two-thirds of the way into it.
Yeah. Wow, I can't wait.
Okay. Yeah, and she's a very interesting character. She used to write kind of high-toned erotica for the Olympia Press in Paris under the pen name Harriet Daimler. And she's a fascinating woman. She only wrote one other novel under her real name, which was Iris Owens.
Wow.
And this is a book that I've been like giving to people for years, long before it was reprinted.
Yeah.
And probably like 40% of them would say, "Oh my God, that book is amazing.
Yeah.
I love that book." And at least 60% would say, "Why did you even think that this would interest me? This is a disgusting, horrible novel."
It's so. Oh, that sounds awesome.
Yeah.
Okay. And I'm going to plug an academic novel, which is Randall Jarrell, Pictures from an Institution.
Oh, yeah.
Do you like that one?
Yes, I love that novel.
I think it's an amazing comedy. And I think we probably don't have time to talk about it, but it's a response to Mary McCarthy's Groves of Academe. And it includes like an unbelievable portrait of a novelist writing a comic novel. This woman, Gertrude, who is at the heart of, who is meant to be Mary McCarthy and is kind of at the heart of Randall Jarrell's novel. I don't know. I have so many great lines from it, but I guess the one I want to emphasize is that, it sort of has to do with this notion of being able to figure out what makes a place different from other places. And so at one point the novel says, "The people of Benton, like the rest of us, were born, fell in love, married and died, lay sleepless all night, saw the first star of evening and wished upon it, won lotteries and wept for you, but not at Benton." So the idea is, yes, fine, life is the same everywhere, but actually... it's different everywhere too. Like no one place is like any other place. And I think, it's a novel. Robert Lowell reviewed it when it first came out and said it's an inspired joke book. Mm-hmm. And I get that it is a joke book, but I feel like it's what's inspired about it is so much more than it just being a joke book.
Well, it's funny when I read The Sellout, I was thinking the only thing that I can compare it with in the terms of the, line by line intensity of the, comic insight was Pictures from an Institution.
Yeah. So. Awesome. Okay. So, Steve, thank you so much. It's been a huge pleasure. And I'll just end by saying that Recall This Book is the brainchild of John Plotz and Elizabeth Ferry. It's affiliated with Public Books, and it's recorded and edited in the Media Lab of the Brandeis Library by Plotz Ferry and also a cadre of colleagues here in the Boston area and beyond. Our music comes from a song by Eric Chaslow and Barbara Cassidy, Fly Away. Sound editing is by Anil Tripathi. Production assistance from Matthew Schratz. Mark DeLello oversees and advises on technological matters. And we appreciate the support of Brandeis generally and specifically of the university librarian Matthew Sheehy and the dean Dorothy Hodgson. We always want to hear from you with your comments, criticism, or suggestions for future episodes. You can email us directly or contact us via social media or our website, which is recallthisbook.org. And finally, if you enjoyed today's show, please be sure to write a review or rate us on iTunes or Stitcher or wherever you get your podcast. You may be interested in checking out past episodes, which include topics like opiate addiction, minimalism, old and new media, and also a lovely recent interview with Madeline Miller, the author of Circe. Upcoming episodes will include a conversation with Samuel Delaney, another science fiction author, who Steve probably also hasn't read.
Oh, you have. Good.
All right. I love that guy. And a discussion of animals, poetical and otherwise, with the poet David Ferry and the biologist E.O. Wilson. And also a Recall This Book First, which is a collaboration with Harvard's Mahindra Humanities Center on the topic of distraction. So for all of us here, thanks for listening today.